does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it
all. Cleveland is a city of a lot of punchlines, and usually it's kind of low-hanging fruit. But I'll be honest, I think it's kind of – I have a great appreciation for Cleveland. I think it's kind of a cool town. It's where Jeremiah Johnson is because the Pacers are going to be there tonight taking on the Cavs in this, the penultimate game of the regular season. They wrap things up on Sunday at the Fieldhouse against the Atlanta Hawks. And we will begin by asking Jeremiah Johnson this question. And, Jeremiah, that is that – it becomes real convoluted, and we probably could lose the audience quickly if we try to figure out all of the different scenarios for the Pacers. But it is true to say that they still can go as high as the 3 seed, and they still can fall as low as having to play in a play-in game. Is that correct?
That is correct. Technically, right now on playoffstatus.com, which seems to have a pretty good handle of things, the 3 seed is very unlikely, but there is a 1% chance. So if you're wanting home court advantage in the first round, you really probably got to focus on what it would take to get the 4 seed, which actually is not that unrealistic if you get a win tonight against Cleveland. Basically, you need to win your final 2 games and have the Magic lose one of their final 2, and they've got 2 challenging games. So I remember a month ago when the Pacers were maybe 7th or 8th and jockeying for getting above that line to be in the top 6, and Rick Carlisle, I think, on your airwaves was asked about that, and he said that's a low goal. We want to set our sights higher. We want to be a home court advantage. Where they have that opportunity in front of them, they don't control their own destiny for 4, but they have a really good shot if they can win these games.
Okay, let's begin with this standpoint in terms of tonight, Jeremiah, and pardon my not knowing this. Is this situation the same for Cleveland, or is Cleveland locked in? In other words, does Cleveland go into tonight's game with things still left to play for?
They do absolutely have things to still play for, although the same website lists their chances at number 7 at just 1%. So I would say probably a little bit less sense of urgency. However, their opportunity to get the 4 seed, I think, is really in their hands. And if they can win these final 2 games, they should be in a pretty good spot. I'm not sure on how Orlando would tie into those things. So if they're fighting for home court advantage and that's important to them, they have a little bit better chance, and they would simply need to win these final 2 games. I think they've got a pretty easy game coming up on Sunday. So they really probably put it all out there. And this is what's fun about this final weekend. You never know when the schedule comes out if the games will impact both teams. But teams in 4, 5, 6, and 7, Cavs, Magic, Pacers, Sixers, they play each other. So it'll be fun to watch the scoreboard. And we should note, the Pacers win tonight, they lock in top 6, or if the Sixers lose. So we might know even before the game is over that the Pacers are in, but they want to do it themselves with the win and not through help.
Jeremiah Johnson, Pacers sideline reporter for Bally Sports Indiana, is our guest. JJ, as you look at this team, and I know 2 games is tough to necessarily have massive growth, but when you look at them and how far they've been on this journey from the trades, the loss of Benedict Mathurin, the acquisition of Pascal Siakam, but the loss by acquisition as well of Buddy Hield, where is there still, if any, room for this team to grow? Because I will admit, it feels like they are playing some of their best basketball to close, but where are there still areas of improvement that can be improved upon going into the postseason?
I would say getting stops in crucial situations. They haven't had as many opportunities to win clutch games since the trade, or even maybe since the All-Star break. That's why I thought the Miami game was really good. And they don't win that game if they're not excellent offensively from about that 5-minute mark till about 2 minutes to play. And it wasn't just throw the ball to Pascal Siakam or rely on Tyrese Halliburton to make plays. All 5 of the guys on the court were contributing. Now on the other end, they were unable to get those stops against the Heat. And granted, Tyler Hero was in a little bit of a zone, and there were a couple of fouls that you'd like to have not committed. But I guess in a late-game situation, this isn't entirely new. It's secure those defensive rebounds and get those defensive stops. They have the system in place to play better defensively from start to finish. They're still not, you know, a top 10 defensive team, but their season numbers are not reflective, I think, of where they are. I think their season numbers are going to still say 24th or 25th in defensive rating, but it feels like they're more in that 15 to 20 range, which if you're still top two, top three in offense, then that's serviceable. So I would say just the late game situations, getting that stop, getting that defensive rebound, it's something they'll continue to need to remind players of in the late game situations, and things that you'll still be watching intently if the game's a one possession game with a couple of minutes to play.
Jeremiah, over the last week or so, we've talked about how the Pacers need to be approaching this final stretch to close the regular season like it is single elimination. Every game is a playoff game because every game can help you push yourself further away from the play-in tournament and get yourself closer to potentially, even as Rick Carlisle's mentioned, getting to host a playoff series. How much did the mentality that was required in the in-season tournament of literally treating those games like the quarterfinal and the semifinal for what they were as single elimination games, do you think help in the stretch run here of treating these games the same way, even though the stakes aren't literally as big?
Every experience that you get, you put in your back pocket and you can draw upon that. It's the same with, hey, as a broadcaster, the first time you did a show, Jimmy, I'm sure, you know, you didn't maybe do as well as you would have liked, but every time you got one of those situations on a big day, you improved. And so the difference is the team feels so much different than it was in the play-in tournament and those games, or I should say the in-season tournament and the games in Las Vegas, because your rotations were different. Having a starting lineup of Obi Toppin and Bruce Brown and potentially Buddy Hield either in the starting lineup or coming off the bench is a lot different when three of your top six or seven players, Benedict Mathurin's not healthy, than what you're seeing right now. That being said, to have success in the big games, what I think it did is it allowed them to win some of those games. Let's say those Bucks games in early January, the game that Tyrese Halliburton was injured, you were able to dig down deep and get a win against Boston. And those listening know, you're almost as confident against a good team in an impactful situation as you are in a game against a team that's out of the mix. And so good news is every game you're going to play is against a team that is still going to be playing in the postseason. The Hawks don't have a winning record, but you still have a lot of importance to that game. And so I do think what they did in November and December, it does help them, but you can't just rely on the same game plan because you do feel like you're a little bit different team right now than you were then.
Jeremiah Johnson is our guest. Bally Sports, of course, where you can see his work, sideline reporter for the Pacers television broadcast. Jeremiah, is that the Pacers are obviously playing well, right? They're finishing strong here. Is there still an Achilles, though, that maybe their strong play of late is kind of masking that you have a concern about that could rear its head a little bit here in the postseason?
You have a weird roster where you've got some guys that have some playoff experience, but maybe not deep playoff success. And then you've got guys that have never done it before. So to Jimmy's point, I think that you could almost treat what you had earlier as that playoff experience. But how will, Aaron Nesmith in a big role in a playoff series, Andrew Nembhard, Tyrese Halliburton, how will they react if they get there? I think you still look at offensively, can they play the way they play when they're successful, that's getting out and running in a playoff series or a matchup against a really good defensive team when the game slows down. That's probably the biggest question mark I would have going into the playoffs. It's tough to really project to say what you need to do to have success in the playoffs until you officially lock it in. But health is probably one of the most important things right now. And even when you're watching games in the last week, you're seeing Zion Williamson. He went to the locker room and everyone in New Orleans had to hold their breath just a little bit. Giannis Antetokounmpo, we don't know where he is. The Pacers, Benedict Mathurin is injured. But other than that, knock on wood, they're in a really good spot. So that might be a big reason why they're having success right now, and it also might be the most important thing to follow as you look forward to next week.
The easy answer here, Jeremiah, is going to go with a team that simply the Pacers had the worst record against in the regular season. I get it. But in terms of looking at those that are most likely to be like 1 through 7 seeds, give me the best and worst matchup for Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really locking into maybe the 4 most likely scenarios. And I know that you could get up to 3 and Philadelphia could be 6. The chances of playing the Sixers in the first round, not a great chance. And also they would not be near the top of the list of the teams that I would like to face. So the 4 that you're really considering to me are Bucks, Knicks, Cavs, and Magic. And while you had the least amount of success in the regular season against Orlando, I guess I would still put them atop the list because I don't know if their offense is built to really have a long run of postseason success. They play good defense, but their offense does get bogged down a little bit. And I guess just most recently, the Pacers played really well at Orlando. Now, the two games at Gainbridge Fieldhouse against the Magic, they did not go so well. So I would understand if fans don't want to see them. The one that might be the most entertaining series is probably the one that I'm least interested in seeing, at least in the first round, and that would be the Knicks. I know they don't have Julius Randle, but I'm real impressed with the style of play, the attitude they play with, and you know, it's a challenge if you would have to play the Knicks in a series where you don't have the home court advantage. I just feel like that's probably the least desirable matchup. I'd probably rather go take my chances against the Bucks than the Knicks. But that being said, when you haven't been in since 2020, and that was unique circumstances, I don't think anyone with the Pacers will complain about any of the matchups as long as they're still participating.
You know, the Knicks are interesting too, Jeremiah, because they've got guys that kind of reinvented themselves. I mean, I don't watch it in terms of other teams like you would have to, you know, in terms of game in and game out. But just for example, like Dante DiVincenzo, whose name is hard for me to say, but, you know, look, he's played really well for them. And all of a sudden now that gives them, I know Randle not being there hurts them, but it gives them a dynamic. You know, for that matter, Hartenstein's played well for him. Like, they seemingly have guys that you kind of feel like the sand is running through the hourglass on them. But at some point you got to say, you know what, these guys can play, right?
Yeah, they play with a little bit of an edge, and it starts with Jalen Brunson. He might get top five votes, at least for MVP, probably looking like maybe second team All-NBA based on some of the podcasts and the people with votes that I've heard talk. And OG Anunoby, the question mark is always health. If he's healthy, he's really scary, and he sort of completes that lineup even if you don't have Julius Randle. And I watched them just dismantle Boston last night, and Boston didn't have as much to play for, and I still think Boston's probably the better team. But you have to give your respect to the Knicks and what they've accomplished. And, again, it would be a fun series. It'd be worth watching. I'm sure a lot of the games would get a lot of attention. You'd get a little more chatter nationally about a Pacers-Knicks series than maybe the others. But, yeah, the edge that they play with, the physicality and the defensive ability, again, it's not near the top of my list in the most desired matchups.
You know, Jeremiah, the reality is that in the playoffs, you are seeing, you know, this is Captain Obvious here, you're seeing the same team upwards of seven games, okay? You've got to reinvent a little bit, I think, teams, and you tell me. My thought is that it's important to have maybe two styles you can play, maybe even at times three if you've got to kind of do a little bit of chess match. But can that be dangerous in reinventing yourself within the same series? Or is Rick Carlisle more the kind of coach of like, look, we're pushing all in, this is who we are and how we play, and we're going to take our chances for seven games?
Yeah, it's a good question. He has so much experience in these situations. I'm looking forward to seeing how he approaches it, because so often in a playoff series, you talk about the adjustments from one game to the next. The team loses game one, they're likely to tweak some things and give it everything they've got to get back in the series and win game two. You're going to be very familiar with whoever you play. I mean, right now the most likely opponent is the Cavs. Well, the Pacers will play them tonight and then potentially play them again 8 days later. So how much will you draw upon and change, make an adjustment from what happens tonight if you potentially play them again next weekend? You've got to start with what you do best, but you've got to be aware that while you know what you do best, so does the opposition. So that's the first thing they're going to try to take away. So you've got to be ready to quickly adjust. And one great example of this that I think, you know, answers your question a little bit is what you saw in the game against Miami last Sunday. It was treated a little bit like a playoff game, and rarely do we see Miles Turner on the court at the start of the second quarter and at the start of the fourth quarter, but Rick Carlisle acknowledged the importance to have Miles on the floor when Bam Adebayo was on the floor, and that's the way they played it, and it worked out well. So you put more preparation, you put more scheme into a playoff series, and that's part of what makes it so enjoyable to watch and to cover.
Jeremiah Johnson of Bally Sports Indiana is our guest. Jeremiah, so far in the matchup for the season series between the Pacers and the Cavs, tonight's opponent in Cleveland, Pacers have taken two of the three matchups and tiebreaks galore on the line tonight against Cleveland. When you look at the matchups of Donovan Mitchell and, let's say, Tyrese Halliburton, or of Nesmith or Nembhard, and you look at the matchups of Evan Mobley versus either Pascal Siakam or Miles Turner, depending on the situation, what challenges are present for Indiana and vice versa, what challenges the Pacers present to the Cavs?
It's really one of those contrast of styles type of games, because J.B. Bickerstaff is one of those coaches. It's not very cool in the NBA to say you want to play slow. He doesn't necessarily say that, but he acknowledges that an up-and-down game doesn't fit his team. So if the game's 105 to 97 or even, you know, 110 to 105, it benefits the Cavs. It's what they kind of want to do. Meanwhile, you know, the Pacers, they routinely get above 140, and they've got that capability to wear the Cavs out and to not allow them to get in their half-court set. So as simple as watching at halftime, seeing how many points have been scored, seeing the number of fast break opportunities the Pacers have, I think that'll go a long way towards who has success. You know, Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland, they're two of the best guards in the league, but it hasn't always worked well when they've shared the court together. So I do wonder, you'll see maybe some staggering where one of them's on the court at all times. Can the Pacers second unit continue to have success if, let's say, Darius Garland is out there to start the second quarter? I mean, the Pacers bench has been one of the biggest reasons for their success all season long. As you get towards the postseason, maybe those guys don't play as much, but I still think when they're on the court, they have a chance to be effective. So I'll be watching the bench minutes from the Pacers, and I'll be watching to see the pace. If it favors Indiana, it's up and down. It's a lot of points. Even though you give some up, you get more than you give. And then if the Cavs are successful, maybe it's a lower scoring game.
What do you make of the journey this season of TJ McConnell? Jake and I talked about this yesterday, and to go from Rick Carlisle lamenting around the opener about the fact that he wasn't sure what type of minutes availability would be there for TJ McConnell. And we know that the moves they've made this season and the injuries they've suffered have kind of forced McConnell into this spot, but he hasn't blinked from it. Like, I think we're well past the point that what he's doing, 17, 18 a night in 20 or so minutes, we're well past the point of that being sustainable. It clearly is what he is capable of doing at this point in career. How remarkable is it, that whole journey, just this season for him in a Pacers uniform?
It is. If his career ended at the end of this season, you would say, what an amazing 9-year career for where he was coming out of college and what he was able to accomplish. But when the season started, there probably had to be a little bit of concern. His contract situation is such that there's a team option, but not necessarily a guarantee for next season. And so I'm sure there were some thoughts in his head. Is this it? Now you're wondering, how long can this go? I mean, he's definitely someone that deserves another contract. LeBron James is talking about him on a podcast. Think back to the Buddy Hield trade. I think a lot of that was to help Buddy out. That was what he wanted to do for his personal contract situation. But maybe it was also meant to open up, you know, scoring and responsibility options for a guy like Benedict Mathurin and a guy like Ben Shepherd. Well, what it did is it opened the opportunity for TJ McConnell to be even more of a scorer, and he's embraced that. And it's just amazing to me. He does two or three things as well as anybody, maybe doesn't do the other things that the average NBA player does, but you know, going into the game, what he's going to do, and you still are just unable to stop it. I mean, the way he drives to the basket and the way he gets to the lane and shoots that pull-up jumper, even though it's against guys that maybe 6 to 8 inches taller than him, if not more, it's fun to watch. It's remarkable, and it's kind of one of the reasons you tune in. I think you watch these games, you love Tyrese Halliburton, but you especially get on the edge of your seat when TJ McConnell checks in because of what he's been able to do. So I'll give him credit. The beginning of the season, he had to be down a little bit by the news that he was maybe going to be out of the rotation, but he kept working, and it's a lesson for anybody. When you get that chance, you show you can perform, you're likely going to get another opportunity.
Just circle around that baseline a couple times and then get yourself an 8-footer, right? And then steal an inbound. JJ, yeah. Have you been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland?
I have not.
Okay, you got time right now to walk over there. Now, here is their 2024 nominee class for induction. What I need to know is, we can do this one of two ways. You can tell me the four that are most likely to be found within the playlist of Jeremiah Johnson on your phone, or you can simply tell me the four that you find to be most worthy of induction upon this list. Which option do you want to go with here once I read them off to you?
I'll go with most likely on my
in your
phone.
Okay, here we go. Here is the list. Mary J. Blige, Mariah Carey, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Eric B. and Rakim. That's together, by the way. Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Jane's Addiction, Kool and the Gang, Lenny Kravitz, Oasis, Sinead O'Connor, Ozzy Osbourne, Sade, and A Tribe Called Quest.
All right, so before I answer, why don't you guess? What do you think is most likely on my phone? Wait, let me... actually, I pulled the list up just so I'd know. One, two, three, for sure, four. Okay, I got my four.
I'm going to say that you spent enough time around David Benner that Dave Matthews Band is in the mix.
It is.
Okay.
Crash.
Well, we all have our weakness. Okay, I don't know if you know this or not. Dave Matthews Band basically is just a bus that drives over Chicago rivers dropping poo and going, hey, that's the Dave Matthews Band.
Hey, I know anybody that's popular you have a problem with. They're a little too mainstream for you, Jake.
You seem to me to be a little bit of a Lenny Kravitz guy. I'll go with Lenny Kravitz.
I did not. I don't have much Lenny Kravitz on my phone, no.
Okay. I talked to Bob the other day. Lenny, to me, is interesting because Lenny Kravitz is one of those guys that, like, everyone likes just fine. But, like, nobody's like, oh, I'm a diehard. You know what I mean? Elvis Costello's the same way. Okay, I'm going to say that you've got a little bit of Oasis in your phone.
That is correct.
Yeah, they're the best, man.
Fun fact, back in the day, Union Station used to have concerts, kind of high school, college age. I don't know if you remember those, Jake, but there was one time we were walking to, I believe, the Toadies concert. And the next night, Oasis was supposed to be performing somewhere, and they get out of their bus, and they walk in with us. And so we had a photo op. Unfortunately, we don't have phones from back then. I don't know where the pictures are, but I had a brief encounter with Oasis,
dude,
and I've got a little bit of that on my phone.
I slept on Oasis when they were, like, current, and then I did a deep dive on them about 6 or 7 years ago, and they're, like, in the top three in Aquarius rotation. Oasis is absolutely fabulous. Okay, the other two on this list that I'm going to guess that you have within the mix, I'm going to go a little bit out of left field here and say Jane's Addiction.
Nope.
Okay. But were you ever caught stealing?
No.
Okay. How about a little Ozzy Osbourne?
No. All right. I mean, that one was close, but...
Tribe Called Quest.
Foreigner would probably be, old school enough, just kind of... I'm more mainstream than you. And then the other one, which is, I'm maybe not proud to admit this, but I've got Christmas songs on my phone for that time of the year. So Mariah Carey just came to mind as one that would be on
my phone. I revealed the other day on the show that when I was an intern at MTV, some guy said he knew Mariah Carey. And I'm like, no, you don't. And then the next day he brought in Polaroids of Mariah Carey skinny dipping. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you do know her. So that was cool, right? Here's the thing. Eric B. and Rakim's cool. Tribe Called Quest is cool. All of these are actually pretty good. Peter Frampton, Frampton Comes Alive, was recorded. Part of it was recorded in the Long Island Arena, which is now a Fresh Market in Commack, New York. And I went in there, and I was delighted to know that the manager knew of that fun fact. And nobody else seemed to know. I stopped people in the aisles. I'm like, did you know that Frampton Comes Alive was recorded right here in the middle of the zucchini aisle? And I almost got arrested.
And what year was this?
Like 3 months ago.
Oh, okay. I say you've had that in your back pocket so you could talk about it here, but you've only had it there for a short amount of time.
I mean, Jeremiah, listen, most stories that I tell that sound like I might have been 15, it was like, no, I was 50. That's okay, though.
Hey, we all want to be kids. You acknowledge this frequently on the show. You want to be able to act like you did then.
That's right.
There's nothing wrong with that every once in a while.
Okay, we will let you request it, Jeremiah, even though you're in Cleveland and you won't hear it. Of those that I just mentioned, for our bounce back song when we come back from break on the other side, you would like to hear which?
Does it have to be from one of these Hall of Fame inductees?
That is correct. Mary J. Blige, Mariah Carey, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Eric B. and Rakim, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, James Addiction, Kool and the Gang, Lenny Kravitz, Oasis, Sinead O'Connor, Ozzy Osbourne, Sade, Tribe Called Quest.
I'll go, What's the Story, Morning Glory, Oasis.
All right. I got nothing wrong with that, man. We could go Oasis for the rest of the show. How's that? Can I declare that Oasis for the rest of the show?
Well, it's your show as long as the company portion of the show is okay with it.
You're the official music director for the company, Jeremiah. Okay. We will see if the Pacers tonight, I'm trying to work in some way of saying like that they're looking for an oasis in terms of a playoff drought, but the desert of playoff drought for the Pacers, this is the year that they find the oasis and get a playoff series victory. How's that?
There you go. I may not use it on the pregame show, but I'll consider it.
You don't even have to credit me if you do. We'll be watching, Jeremiah. Appreciate it.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Augusta National, the place to be as the sports world and certainly the world of golf turns attention to the Masters. I will let you know right now, as Doug Bell's about set to join us from PGA Tour Live, PGA Radio, also a contributor for CBS Sports, has vast history in covering many a Masters. Right now, Santiago de la Fuente, again, the sleeper, and I know that people...
He's asleep, right? No, listen,
he's just one stroke behind Jordan Spieth. He is a stroke up on Bubba Watson. He is two strokes up on Dustin Johnson. He's four up on Fred Couples. He's also tied for 80th. He's eight over. Probably not going to make the cut, but Santiago, he's just getting his feet wet, and then it's going to come like a brush fire. Doug Bell joins us on the program now, and I'm sure probably is perplexed as to why that's the lead-in that we're talking about. Doug, I had made the bold prediction that Santiago de la Fuente, mostly just because I like Arturo Fuente cigars, was going to make a run. But let's turn our attention and focus on what's happening up top of the leaderboard. Anything so far at Augusta that has surprised you, good or bad, for anybody?
Well, first off, you were talking about Santiago, and I was scrambling. I was like, oh, my goodness. So they're going to ask me about Santiago? You had me worried, guys. No, listen, it's first off, it's a gorgeous day at Augusta. I mean, it's beautiful, but the wind is howling. And right now, pars are at a premium. I mean, if you can steal a birdie or two, you're in great shape. And that's what Max Homa is doing. A couple of birdies, no bogeys, clean card. So a great day for him. And he's playing with Tiger, who has three. You know, it's funny, Tiger's first nine today, guys. Three pars, three birdies, three bogeys. So it's worth the price of admission, obviously. And we're waiting for Scotty Scheffler to tee off. He tees off in about 13 minutes. And DeChambeau is one over today. So a lot of storylines are brewing. But, you know, you got to get off to a really good start here. We haven't had a comfort behind winner on the weekend in more than a decade at Augusta National. So it's absolutely crucial for these guys to play well today.
Doug, how do you put into layman terms with everything that Tiger Woods has gone through in terms of his body and the car accident a couple years ago? How do you put into terms how big of a wrench is thrown in there when his tee time gets pushed back like other golfers did because of weather? And now instead of playing 18 separated, you know, 18, effectively 36, but 18 on Thursday and then 18 today, and now increasing that by nine holes. How do you put that in layman's terms, what that does to his body?
Well, first off, guys, what happened yesterday with a 2.5 hour rain delay was a nightmare for him. And you used the term threw a wrench into it. That messed up the plan. That the game plan was out the window. And as he walked off the course last night, guys, he put it out at 13, out of gas, completely out of gas. And so he took the cart gladly to the clubhouse. You know, he got up this morning around 3:30 a.m. just to get his body what he hoped was ready for the five holes this morning and then the 45-minute turnaround to what would be round number two. So I guess what you're asking is, how would you put it in layman's terms? Listen, he's a 48-year-old man with a 78-year-old body. And even Dottie Pepper this morning, when they first came on at 7:45 Eastern, within the first 5 minutes of the broadcast, she was like, wow, Tiger does not look loose. I mean, he looks stiff. And then he hit the side over a 9-iron at 14 and bogeyed that hole right out of the gate. So, listen, I'm watching now. He has a pronounced limp. It'll get worse as the day goes on. But right now, he's probably two or three shots ahead of the rest of the guys right there at the cut line. And you know, it's interesting, guys. You know, it used to be we would always talk about Tiger and his chances to win, and now the storyline is, can Tiger keep his cut streak alive at 24 years in a row? So it's just great to have him out. And listen, he still moves the needle, guys. There's no golfer in the world who moves the needle like him. The galleries, the patrons, it is a massive crowd out there watching he and Max Homa and Jason Day. It's crazy how many people are out there.
Doug, when I think about Tiger Woods, you know, for so long, and look, take aside or take, if you go away from the fact that he, you know, his unbelievable golf acumen, I mean, that goes without saying, but right. He had such an advantage for so long because of the invincibility of him and the old you know, the old adage that, like, guys, when they knew Tiger was lurking, Tiger was unflappable, right? They're just, he was impermeable to the pressure. And then, literally and figuratively, he finally tasted his own blood. And his vulnerability was exposed, not just to the masses, but to Tiger Woods to an extent. What golfer now that you look at has, would you say, is the closest to that complete, like, invisibility of pressure and that just has the mental edge over competitors?
Wow. And what an awesome question. Listen, Jack had it back in the 60s, 70s, and leaking into the 80s, and had the same invincibility. I mean, everybody knew how good he was, and he knew that you knew how good he was. You know, the old boxing adage, right? And then it loops all the way to Tiger. So what you're asking, it's few and far between the players who had that intimidation level, which matched this incredible talent. And right now, we're on the cusp of Scottie Scheffler being in that category. And listen, guys, that is rarefied air. But when you look at the statistics, the analytics between Scottie Scheffler and number two Rory McIlroy, and we're talking about, not to get technical, tee to green. I mean, they calibrate all this stuff. You have to go back 22 years to when Tiger won back-to-back green jackets. That's the gap. That's how good he is playing compared to everybody else in the world. It was on display yesterday, bogey-free 666. We'll see how he does today with these crazy winds at Augusta National. I suspect he's going to go out and probably go one or two under, and he'll head into the weekend probably the leader 8 under. But that's the guy right now, guys. And you know, different from Tiger and Jack, you know, he's not – and I don't want to say Tiger and Jack were arrogant, but there, you described it. There was that level of like, oh, my goodness. I mean, he steps into the arena and he's – you don't get that from
this guy. Doug, it's so rare in any sport to find athletes that cause other athletes to wilt. And that's what those guys did, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Scottie's on the verge, guys. He's on the verge of doing that. He is that good. He's, you know, I said last night on CBS Sports HQ, he is so boring, he's brilliant. I mean, think about that. I mean, he's just fairways, greens, up and down. Oh, okay, let's knock it in from the bunker. Let's two putt from 95 feet. Ho-hum, here we go again. And that's kind of what we're getting at every time he tees it up, Scottie Scheffler.
Doug Bell of PGA Tour Radio and CBS Sports taking some time with us as we get set for the weekend at Augusta. Round two ongoing right now at Augusta National Golf Course. Speaking of a golfer that, at least in this generation, Doug, has been viewed by many as relatively polarizing for sometimes in feuds, most notably with Brooks Koepka back a couple years ago, in Bryson DeChambeau, a comment of his yesterday, and I believe he said it to Scott Van Pelt, said it a couple areas as well, about Augusta and how his perspective has changed from his first year playing it a couple years back to where he is now, that I thought was pretty poignant. He said that he has a level of respect for this golf course that's a bit different than it was a couple years ago. Clearly today was a great test of golf. I was able to conquer a very difficult golf course today. He later paraphrased, I'm paraphrasing here, but he later said that, you know, to think that you're just going to come into Augusta National and light it on fire right out of the gate is foolhardy. How much of that sentiment echoes true, regardless if it's your first time or your third time at Augusta National?
Well, I think what you just laid out was, I mean, we're watching, and we don't see him anymore because he's on the other tour, right? That's why it's kind of fun to have him back, because he is such an interesting guy. But I think we're seeing the maturation process of a young man. He's growing up. I mean, before, some of the stuff that he would say, Augusta National's a par 68. I mean, he would say these outlandish things, and it was almost like coming out of the mouth of a teenager. But now I think we're seeing a young man who's growing up. He's understanding the importance and the opportunities of playing in an event like this. And I think he sees, oh, my goodness, my U.S. Open five-year exemption may be running out. I need to keep playing well in these majors so I can keep coming back. And so I think reality is setting in somewhat. You know, I described it yesterday, guys, on CBS. And I love seeing all these guys. I mean, we never see DeChambeau or Rahm or Koepke anymore because they're on live. But I said, who is this guy, DeChambeau? He's like, you know, the wrestler who comes out of nowhere with a mask on, and the wrestling crowd goes crazy, like, who is this guy? And he rips off the mask, and they go crazy, and that's kind of what we had with DeChambeau yesterday. It's like, wow, I remember how good he was, and he's still pretty good. And to think on his hat, guys, it's that crazy team deal in live. And he's got a skull and crossbones on his hat. That is so DeChambeau, you know? I mean, it's every time I see that goofy hat, I laugh. But I mean, it fits him and his personality perfectly.
Doug, here in Indianapolis, you know, and this is pretty esoteric within the sport I'm talking about, but in the world of auto racing, there was a split 30 years ago where you had one series that decided then to branch off, and now all of a sudden you had drivers in one of two series, the CART series or Champ World, as it later was known, or obviously IndyCar series. And it confused the transcendent viewer of auto racing, and it really hurt the sport. The split hurt the sport. Is golf at that risk now, or have they kind of steadied the tide?
No, it's at risk. And what you described is kind of what's happening in golf, although I think in the Indy racing, you had two legitimate racing vehicles there, if you will. I mean, the LIV, listen, they play 54 holes. They play on resort courses. They're not set up like PGA Tour events. Nobody even watches. I mean, their ratings are not even minuscule. They're non-existent. But when you take away a Rahm, when you take away a Koepke, a DeChambeau, and the list goes on and on, you're hurting the game. And yesterday, Jack Nicklaus, he hit the ceremonial first shot. Then he does his just a slew of interviews. And to hear the 84-year-old champion who has great knowledge, great insight, and he said, listen, he sat down with the PGA Tour commissioner and he said, I don't want to know the details. Just tell me, is this going to work out? I mean, that's all I need to know. And Jay Monahan assured the Golden Bear, Jack, it'll be solved here very shortly. And Jack yesterday in an interview said, listen, that's good enough for me. That's all I wanted to hear, because Jack is right. And that's why yesterday, guys, I described yesterday as I enjoyed that round yesterday more than any round I've watched this year in 2024, mainly because you had everybody back. I mean, I like DeChambeau. I like Rahm. I like all these guys, and I want to see them play more together. And hopefully before 2024 is finished, we'll have somehow resolved the issue. Although I will say this, let me just add this. Greg Norman bought a ticket and made this big deal on social media. He had to buy his own badge on a secondary market, and he's out walking around with the patrons, which I find just fascinating in itself. But then he goes on social media talking about he's talking to all these people or telling him how much they love Liv. And I don't believe that for a second.
Correct. I mean, I would agree. That part seems like it would be posturing and embellishment, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That was outlandish. But that's Greg Norman, right? but I hope we come to some sort of agreement here soon, because the game of golf needs it, guys. The ratings for the Masters is going to be off the charts. It's going to be incredible for the reasons I just described. But the ratings leading into this, the TV ratings are down, way down. And that's because the best players are not playing every week together.
Doug, here's the answer. I've got the answer. Are you a cigar smoker? Have you ever enjoyed a cigar, whether it be on the course or after a round of golf?
Oh, yeah. Okay. A Santiago. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, if next year, and this is what's going to lure people in next year. And I know Tiger Woods is the draw in the deal. I get it. But next year, when everybody knows that they're going to be able to watch and enjoy themselves a fabulous Arturo Fuente because of the breakthrough celebration of the Santiago de la Fuente Masters victory. I was a year early on my prediction, but I'm telling you, Doug, just go ahead and write it down now. Santiago de la Fuente, no longer amateur, your 2025 Masters champion.
Hey, if that happens, I'm going to call you up. You're sending me a box of those things. I mean, I'm telling you right now.
All right.
Doug, who's your winner? And I know we already had the tongue-in-cheek comment, but just know Jake already has De La Fuente off the board. So who's
Joaquin
your winner?
Joaquin Niemann is my actual pick.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow. Well, there you go. Let me tell you, it's so funny because before I went out with CBS before the week was over, it's like, who's your off-the-radar pick? And I picked Brian Harman, and he was looking good at 2 under through 9. and then wound up, you know, with that 47 on the second nine in the opening round. So there goes that pick, kind of like your pick, right? But listen, I hate to go with chalk guys, and this is a boring pick, but that's the way he plays. Scotty Scheffler is going to win another green jacket.
So if you had the choice between Scotty and the field, you'd go Scotty?
Yep. And think about that. That's how good he is right now. But, yeah, I'm going with Scotty. He's getting ready to tee off right now.
Doug, I would like the record to show that Brian Harmon right now is just hoping to shave three strokes to be able to catch up to Santiago de la Fuente. I just want to let you know that, right?
I know. I know. That's why my pick was actually worse than your pick. That's unbelievable.
Doug, we appreciate it, man. A lot of fun, actually. And we'll talk to you again. I appreciate the time.
All right, guys. Cheers.
All right, Doug Bell, again, from PGA Tour Live, PGA Radio, contributor for CBS Sports when it comes to the Masters.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Current cut line at the Masters looks like +3. That means dangerous waters, but not fully.
The cut this
submerged.
Year is going to be +3 plus Santiago.
Yeah, they got to add that in there. I forgot about that factor. It's Augusta cut line plus Santiago equals real cut line.
Uh-huh.
In terms of being near the plus side of the cut line and bringing happiness to myself and our next guest, Tiger Woods currently at +1 through 12, tied for 33rd. Couple of strings of pars, four pars in a row, in fact, and getting immediate reaction with that statement is our next guest, who no doubt enjoyed a little bit of morning golf via Tiger Woods on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy. He is Kevin Bowen. KB, I said earlier today, and I've admitted multiple times, I'm not as big of a Tiger fan as you, but we do share that bond of rooting for Tiger Woods. My level of bar for him over the last couple of years, given the circumstances, has shifted towards make the cut line, and then anything else that happens, like the idea of him being around on Sunday, would be gravy. You might call that loser's mentality, so feel free to revoke my Tiger Woods card, but where's your mentality going into a tournament like Augusta for him?
Yeah, that's one of the softest things I've ever heard, to be totally honest with you. He was my pick to win at the start of the week. We can get in the house one or two under, nothing crazy from Bryson, Scotty here in the afternoon. Who knows? The gate does not look as good. He looks like Matt Ryan scrambling, not Anthony Richardson scrambling. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little worried about how these final few holes are going to go for him, as we are now reaching extra holes, if you will, because he already played five this morning. But I would say continuing the cut streak and setting the record for that would probably be a very complimentary goal, pat him on the back, whatever you want to say. But sure, there's a little bit of hope that 2019 will resurface again and he'll drum up some weekend magic one of these years.
Kevin, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Doug Bell a little bit ago. Part of what I know drew both of you to Tiger Woods at his apex was just the incredible laser focus of Tiger Woods that kind of wilted everything in his path as he came down fairways late in rounds, and other guys just kind of, you know what I mean? It was like, you're like, oh my gosh, here comes the master. Who is the closest you have seen to that, if anyone, since?
No one to that level. I mean, sure, there's been great talents and great runs. And if you were going to say you have to pick somebody, I guess I'd go with Brooks Koepka. But, we watched Koepka blow, a four-shot lead last year in the final round of the Masters. And that's just not stuff that Tiger ever did. And I would just say the other sport-type celebrations he brought to golf, if that makes sense. I feel like that's what, at least as a young kid who, loves seeing the emotion out of them. That's what drew me. I mean, I didn't play golf until Tiger won the Masters in 97. Why would I play golf? That looks boring. That doesn't look fun. That doesn't look enjoyable. And I think he made it you know, look that for me. So yeah, and then sure, as a young kid, you know, the individual dominant athlete, I think you naturally gravitate towards, and he was that. And you know, some of these comebacks, very much self-inflicted. I mean, that is kind of added to the story as well. And 2019 being the cherry on top. And like I said, probably very unlikely he'll ever do it again. But that's why you keep on coming back, is because you just never know. I mean, we birdied the first hole yesterday, and this course has drummed up, you know, older people that have had great success there, being able to do it at an older age. Of course, you know, Jack in 86 is the one that comes to mind. But yeah, I'd probably say no one to answer the question. But I mean, Koepka for, you know, stretches of his career, probably the closest.
Part of the amazement of it, to Jake's point, I think of like Steph Curry's run in the NBA of, this guy hits all the shots. Like, it doesn't matter. He hits everything. That's what it was growing up watching Tiger Woods, that, oh, of course he's going to, you know, get an eagle there or an eagle two or whatever. Oh, of course he's going to make that long putt. Do you think that as golf, and there's a lot of things there, right? LIV, PGA, all that just cannibalism between the two of them and trying to figure out where they can finally make peace. But do you think golf moving forward, whenever it gets that sorted out, need somebody that's able to dominate that way in order to captivate audiences the way it did with him?
Yeah, I think you need that, and or you need villains. And golf has never really been a true kind of villain sport. I think you have to have one or the other. And maybe there's just a level of acceptance of, like, you know what, everyone wants this, like, linear line for ratings, and everyone is like, it should keep on going up and up, and maybe it's just like, you know what, it's just not going to. There might not be another Tiger type of impact. I mean, there's not going to be a Tiger another impact on the game of golf, and that doesn't even begin to discuss, obviously, the splintering and all of that. I mean, you just kind of brought it up, though, Jimmy. Like, I go back to when he won the U.S. Open on a broken leg, and, I mean, Dan Hicks has, I think, one of the more iconic calls in sports of, you know, when Tiger makes that putt to send it into a playoff with Rocco Mediate, you know, he says, did you expect anything different? And, you know, that is kind of sums up the career. Here's this 15-footer on a bumpy green that he has to make to get into a playoff. And the percentages of him making that putt are probably, what, 20-some percent, if you want to, like, nerd out over the math on it. And yet everybody on their couch at that moment thought, there's no chance he misses this. And then they pan to Rocco Mediate, who has one of the better lines as well, and watching it happen in the scoring tent, and Rocco says, I knew he'd make it. Like, it just, you know, MJ shot over Russell, you know, like those sorts of, you know, athletes in that moment, when the stakes are the highest, do you deliver, do you wilt? And more often than not, he delivered, and more often than not, his opponents wilted.
Kevin Bowen is our guest. You hear him each and every morning, of course, on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy on this radio station from 7 until 10 a.m. Kevin, switching gears a little bit. I mean, we are ramping up towards the NFL draft. Yesterday, and I want you to tell me what you think of this, there was a radio station, I think it's the second year in a row I've done this, but in Pennsylvania that does, they literally have someone from every market on each day leading up to the draft do a mock draft for the Colts. Or, you know, for the team of that market, right? And so I was the 15th one, and they were like, we'll send you the draft board of who's gone off the board. And three corners had been taken. Bowers had been taken. And so at that point, I'm like, okay, if three corners are gone, Bowers was gone, the leading edge rusher was gone. So I said, you know what? I'm going to believe in Reggie Wayne's last visit down to Baton Rouge, and I went wide receiver out of LSU. Any chance to, and I don't think that's what's going to happen. They're not going to go wide receiver in one, are they?
No, I mean, I could see it happening. I don't think it's that far-fetched an idea. It's just kind of, how do you view wideout? Do you view it as, and, you know, Chris Bowd, I thought, was pretty candid at the combine and saying, you know, this is, you know, a bit of a generational wide receiver draft class. So how do you then act on that? Do you act on and say, well, that means we can wait on that, or that means there's three or four, you know, insert, you know, top flight. There's three or four Justin Jefferson types or whatever. I'm speaking a bit in hyperbole, obviously. So if you have the opportunity to pounce on that guy at 15, then you do that, because in some drafts there might only be one of those tier one guys or something along those lines. So
I probably have always been a little bit more of a, hey, if the shelf is really stocked at that position, then be patient. You know, go find the scarcer items first. Edge rusher would be one of those, I think, in this year's draft. But again, I go back to, you know, something Ballard said at the end of the season, and clearly they have not acted on it yet. But, you know, Ballard's really first comment in, like, what needs to change? What do we need to do better, et cetera, et cetera? He said, we have to get more explosive. And sure, Anthony Richardson's just natural presence on the field will bring that. You know, with Richardson, it was not going to be methodical 12-play, 80-yard drives. And if you look at his numbers in a brief sample size, he was really inaccurate when you compare him to the rest of the quarterbacks in the NFL. Yet, he was able to move the football rather, you know, pretty well, I would say, because he was able to sprinkle in some big plays where, you know, whatever, 2-yard gain and 3-yard loss, and now it's 3rd and 11. Well, boom, now you have a quarterback that can either throw it down the field or make some plays with his legs. So it can't just be him, I guess is what I'm getting at with that explosive nature. So, you know, given the board that you just laid out there, I mean, if it's three corners gone and an edge rusher and Bowers, wideout wouldn't shock me, honestly. And I don't know if you had the opportunity to, but knowing Ballard, it probably would be a trade back in that scenario.
Less than 2 weeks to the NFL draft. Kevin Bowen is our guest here on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy, 7 to 10 a.m. on these very airways. Of course, you can follow him on Twitter as well, at KBowen1070. Less than 2 weeks from the NFL draft, Kev. And the more I talk to people about the setup of what could happen before the Colts pick at 15, the more I hear people perplexed that mock drafts, which again don't matter in the grand scheme, but mock drafts continue to have Bowers there at 15. Where have you grasped why he still seems to be, at least in perceived mocks, by guys that know what they're doing with these things, like Dane Brugler? Where do you see his trajectory of still being at 15 or in that range, despite him potentially being the best pass-catching option in this draft, or one of the best pass-catching options in this draft?
Probably just because it's a luxury item, or you know, teams in the NFL view, you know, drafting a tight end at whatever, 10 overall, 11 overall is a bit of a luxury thing, and that you've got other more pressing needs. And, you know, tight end last year, I mean, Jimmy, I'm not, you know, breaking any news to you, but just think of the final four teams in the NFL last year. All of them had great tight ends. I mean, you might argue if there's a consistent threat with all four of those teams, or a common threat, I should say, with all four of those teams, it was great tight end play. Well, none of those tight ends were taken in round one. Only one was taken in the first two rounds, Sam Laporta with Detroit. Travis Kelce is a third-round pick. Mark Andrews, a third-round pick. George Kittle, you know, fifth-rounder. And Kittle's probably the one that gets, you know, compared to Bowers the most. You know, I've probably, like, looked into or thought of the Bowers-Colts idea maybe more than any other prospect, and then trying to like put myself into, okay, how does Chris Ballard usually think? If you just looked at Brock Bowers' height and weight, like six, I don't know the exact measurables, but I think it's like 6'3", 245 or something like that. That is not a Chris Ballard tight end. I mean, when you look at Jelani Woods and Mo Alie-Cox and Drew Ogletree, and, you know, sure, Kylan Grant is probably a little bit more in that mold, but even Will Mallory is bigger than that. So
could he be a Shane Steichen tight end, Kevin? I'm sorry to go across certainly. You, but, like, I still think that in Steichen's perfect world, and maybe I'm overemphasizing what Dallas Goedert was in Philadelphia, but I still think in his perfect world, he wants a tight end that is a do-it-all tight end that you're only resting because of a snap count thing versus schematically. Would he fit a Steichen mold? And if so, is that greater?
Unquestionably, or at least it should be greater. I don't pretend to act like I know, you know, who ultimately is going to have final say. I assume it is Ballard, but in my opinion, when it comes to the offensive draft picks, I can say should matter more in that situation. So, you know, the thing about Bowers is, I mean, and everybody watched him in the SEC, he definitely plays bigger than his size, and Georgia lined him up everywhere. I mean, split out wide, you know, blocking tight end, you know, here's the ball on a jet sweep. I mean, I thought one of the things that made Jack Doyle really unique in his time with the Colts is, you know, you could put him on the field and you weren't tipping your hand. Like, Doyle could be a great blocker, and he also could come up with a big catch on 3rd and 6. Well, I mean, Bowers is theoretically that, but, you know, on steroids. Well, obviously, hope not literally, but you know, that even more with what you'd be getting from a versatility standpoint. And again, I think that helps you out when you come out in a huddle and you're not tipping your hand with what your personnel is on the field. So again, to answer the question, Jimmy, I would probably say it's just a little bit more of a, you know, tight end can be a luxury, you know, it's luxury. And look at first round tight ends. You know, there's not a great recent run on them. Granted, you know, some situations probably didn't favor those guys, and you would think here it would favor them, but it's certainly a thought that I've had myself, and I've tried to, you know, kind of put myself in other people's shoes of the why behind it.
Do you think, Kevin Bowen is our guest here, was wondering about this with the Colts' priority to, quote, you know, re-sign their own. And I get it, and I think that part of it is because they do think that Anthony Richardson's going to kind of elevate guys, right? But do you think that there are times where the Colts prioritize re-signing their own to validate Chris Ballard's selection and belief in them to begin with?
Boy, that'd be one of the more egotistical thoughts you could have as a person in a position of authority. I guess my first response would be, I would hope not. You know, that's not the problem. That sounds like travel baseball stuff. You know, third grade. What an awful shot by Tiger. Yeah. Yeah, that would be much more of a, that would be just a horrific decision-making process and all of that. Ballard, you know, I'm not going to pretend like, you know, him and I go get coffee every other day, but he does not strike me as that individual, to be totally honest. I think there have been people in positions of authority like that, that if you asked me that question, I would probably think about it a little bit more. Ballard does not strike me as that human. Now, is there an element of, like, stubborn belief in his process and his system? I think that is a totally fair statement, but to do it from like a, I'm here to prove people wrong and like almost in spite. I would hope not for the Colts' sake. And in all seriousness, I don't think Ballard strikes me as that.
Were there any re-signs either because of the player it was, or, you know, the alleged number that it was to bring them back that surprised you?
Yeah, I think that is a fair question to bring up. You know, Pittman, I would say no. You know, Grover Stewart and Kenny Moore, I think, are interesting ones in that they undoubtedly would have been losses, you know, had the Colts not re-signed them. But I think the question becomes, you know, probably more with Grover than Kenny, just given your cornerback room is so young and so inexperienced and unproven, and you could even say poor, that – you know, obviously Kenny's presence is needed. You know, Grover, of course, with him last year, you really, really struggled in those six games and stopping the run. I'd have to go back and look at the record. It's not like you went 0-6 in those games. I actually think you were, I think you were 500, if not a little better than that, in those six games. So do you look at that and say, all right, you know, how much are we paying DeForest Buckner? How much are we paying Grover Stewart? Is that the investment you want to make at defensive tackle? Could you bring in Raekwon Davis, for example, who they did sign? Do you view him in more of a starting role? And then all of a sudden, let's say you've saved whatever. I'm just throwing out a number. Let's say you've saved $5 million in the Grover payday versus the other guy payday. Now you have $5 million to play with. Now do you take that and go sign another corner? Maybe have a veteran pass catcher to support that group. I think that's where you kind of get back to the continuity, Jake. To me, continuity is gospel with them. And I understand reasons for wanting continuity, but to be the end, really the end-all be-all and to be gospel, I'm not totally on board with that.
The Fan Zone, Kevin Bowen is our guest. You hear him 7 to 10 a.m. on these very airwaves on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy. You can follow him on Twitter as well at KBowen1070 for all his work on the writing side of things at 1075thefan.com. KB, let's transition to the Pacers. First off, how good does it feel from a coverage standpoint to be able to be covering this team with, in all likelihood, knock on wood, meaningful basketball on the horizon, meaningful playoff basketball on the horizon for them? And what do you see in these next two opponents, Cleveland and Atlanta, this weekend to close things out in the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, to your first point, Jimmy, it's so important for the franchise, so important for the young group. Halliburton, yeah, I mean, everybody involved. It's wild to think the night Darius Leonard was drafted is the last time the Pacers won a playoff game. I mean, Like, think about
yeah, the guy's changed his name since then.
It changed his name. Hell yeah, exactly.
Changed his team.
Right. And it had a hell of a handful of years here as a player. I mean, you got to go back. You know, it'll be about 6 years at the end of this month, the last time they won just a game. I mean, we're not talking a series. It's a decade since they beat John Wall and Bradley Beal and Marcin Gortat in a playoff series.
The like, Polish hammer.
Do you remember, by the way,
Polish
Kevin?
Polish hammer.
Do you remember, like, there was a brief period there where the Wizards-Pacers thing was, like, kind of this, like, new budding rivalry, right?
Yeah, it was kind of like calling the Pacers the old guard would be unfair, but like when Beal and Wall, I mean, they both were, what, under 25 years
right.
old probably at the time. Yeah, I mean, I thought they were like very competitive six-game series.
Totally.
Like the Pacers would win 4-2, but like, and Gortat was just, yeah, I mean, his look just, you want to talk about an intimidating individual. He certainly was that. So, I mean, when you put it in those terms, you know, Joe Young and TJ Leaf were on the floor the last time the Pacers won a playoff game. Like, it's just vital to experience it, to win, of course. But, you know, I said it today to Andy, like, Rick Venturi has said to me before, like, he feels like there's four waves to an NFL season. You have the preseason, you have the regular season, you have December football, and then you have the playoffs. And I guess four waves probably isn't the right way to say it. Maybe four different levels of intensity. I think in the NBA, it's similar to that. And I don't know, maybe the in-season tournament will rise into its own level eventually. But, you know, I just think you talk to anybody, and, you know, playoff basketball is different than a, you know, Tuesday night, three nights and four sort of feeling to it all. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely vital that the Pacers experience it. And then, again, it looks like they will. And, you know, there's a chance, not that far-fetched. If you win tonight, win Sunday, and Orlando loses just one, I mean, we're talking about the Pacers hosting next weekend, game one. I mean, that's crazy. And part of that's just the jumbled nature of the East, but part of that is obviously a big credit to this team, you know, making an 11-win improvement from last season and potentially more.
Where do things stand on the Benedict Mathurin statue?
We've got labor strikes. Yeah, we've got some labor strikes from
the sculptor's hurt, right?
Say it again.
The sculptor's hurt, right? He's injured.
The guy that was making it hurt his shoulder.
Gonna shut it down.
Exactly right.
Yeah, we're trying to call that firefighter that did Peyton's statue. We're going to see if he's available to come out of the bullpen here and help us out. But currently on the mend.
All right. But who did I just see that they just commissioned that guy for to do another statue? Gosh darn it, guys, help me out.
You outside of Eastwood?
That is exactly right. They finished. That's, you know, actually,
it was Santiago de la Fuente. That's who it
right.
was.
That's right. Down in Augusta. Yeah. My name is on a plaque at Eastwood. And they misspelled it, just so you know. My name's on a plaque at Eastwood and North Central. How about that? Not at Allisonville. No plaque at Allisonville. We're working on that.
Oh, what was the misspell? Did we add an A in the query? I'm trying to think of how we
Q-U-E-R-R-Y. Extra R. I'm like, okay. all the years I put in for the Beastwood football team, 2 years undefeated, and on the plaque they misspelled my name. Sorry. They even told me, they said, you know, they told us when we were in eighth grade, they're like, you know, someday you can bring your lady by and show her the plaque. I'm like, well, I can, but Shannon's like, that's not you. That's some other guy with an extra R. That's the way it works. Kevin, enjoy watching the Masters, all right?
Yep. Gentlemen, have a great weekend. Thank you.
All right,
you.
Kevin Bowen. You can hear him 7 o'clock in the morning. They'll be recapping the Masters.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between. Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.